I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
It was like a classic kidnap, like the ones they used to do. It just hasn't happened in a long time. They came, threw the taxi driver out of the car. They got in, put my head down and tied my hands. They put me on my knees and a pistol to my head.
Prominent Russian journalist Elena Melashina suffers brain injury after being violently attacked while reporting in Chechnya. We'll go to Moscow. But first to Kyiv, as Ukrainians mourn the death of writer Victoria Amelina. She was killed in a Russian airstrike in Kramatorsk. We'll speak with her friend Andrei Kirkov, one of Ukraine's best-known authors. He says her smile sparkled even in the most difficult times. Then to Syria, where the United Nations has established an independent body to investigate what happened to more than 130,000 people who've gone missing during the 12-year conflict. We'll also look at a new BBC documentary, Captagon, inside Syria's drug trafficking empire.
My search reveals the role of Syria's most powerful family.
No smuggler operates without connections to the regime.
And I uncover how the Syrian regime itself has become addicted to Captagon.
If Assad stopped the drug trade for 20 days, the economy would collapse.
And here in the United States, we'll speak with Congressmember Ro Khanna. He's introduced a bill to limit Supreme Court justices to 18-year terms. He was also the only member of the House Armed Services Committee to vote no on the new Pentagon budget. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The International Atomic Energy Agency says it's seen no evidence to back claims by Ukraine's government that Russia's military has planted explosives at the Russian-held Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant in southern Ukraine. But the IAEA said it needs additional access to all six of Zaporizhzhia's reactor buildings to be sure. Both Moscow and Kyiv have accused each other of preparing to sabotage Europe's biggest nuclear plant. Overnight, a Russian missile attack on the western city of Lviv killed at least four people and injured 32 others. In eastern Ukraine, an airstrike triggered a massive fireball in the Russian-occupied city of Makiivka. Russian officials said the strike hit a hospital, killing one person, injuring dozens. Ukraine's military says the video clearly shows it struck a Russian arms depot. In Minsk, Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko said earlier today the head of Russia's Wagner Group is not in Belarus and is instead in St. Petersburg, Russia. His surprise announcement came after Russian state TV broadcast images of police raids on Yevgeny Prigozhin's office in St. Petersburg and one of his mansions. Prigozhin has not been seen publicly since June 24th. President Lukashenko previously claimed Prigozhin had arrived in Belarus to live in exile as part of an agreement that ended a mutiny by Wagner forces as they advanced to within 120 miles of Moscow. President Biden met with Swedish Prime Minister at the White House Wednesday, ahead of NATO's annual summit in Vilnius, Lithuania, next week.
Sweden is going to make our alliance stronger and has the same value set that we have in NATO. And really looking forward for your membership.
Sweden's bid to join NATO has been blocked by the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who accuses Sweden of harboring members of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which is considered a terrorist group by Turkey. Turkey's opposition to Sweden joining NATO is now facing a further challenge as protests have broken out in a number of Muslim countries after two men staged a demonstration in which they tore up and burned a Quran outside a Stockholm mosque last week. This is an Iranian protester speaking Monday in front of the Swedish embassy in Tehran.
We declare that we are Muslims, and no country has the right to insult the Quran and cannot desecrate the Quran. And if they insult it, they will be given a strong response.
Pope Francis has also condemned the Quran burning. A federal judge in Louisiana has barred Biden administration officials from asking social media companies to remove misinformation from websites and apps. The ruling has broad ramifications for the ability of government officials to engage with the public through popular online forums. In a 155-page ruling handed down Tuesday, U.S. District Court Judge Terry Doty, a Trump appointee, issued an injunction against federal officials and agencies contacting sites like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, siding with Republican attorneys general who accused President Biden of trying to silence his critics. Judge Doty said several federal officials violated the First Amendment when they asked social media companies to take down misinformation about COVID-19, including false content about vaccines and the effectiveness of wearing masks. The judge also accused officials of suppressing free speech by battling claims that the 2020 presidential election was rigged. Legal observers say the sweeping ruling could end up enjoining hundreds of thousands of government employees from participating in online debate. In more technology news, Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, has officially launched a rival social media platform to Twitter, which has been struggling to retain users and advertisers since its purchase by billionaire Elon Musk last October. In the latest in a series of unpopular moves, Musk said over the weekend Twitter will begin limiting the number of tweets its users would be able to view per day unless they pay for premium service. Meanwhile, Canada's government says it's halted all advertising on Facebook and Instagram after Meta moved to restrict news content across Canada. Meta's move came after Canadian lawmakers approved the Online News Act, which will require tech companies to pay news outlets for posting their content on their platforms. Google's parent company, Alphabet, has also removed Canadian news articles from search results after calling the new law unworkable. President Biden has nominated Elliot Abrams to the bipartisan U.S. Advisory Commission on Public Diplomacy. Elliot Abrams was convicted in 1991 of lying to Congress about the Iran-Contra affair and later pardoned by then-President George H.W. Bush. He defended death squads in Guatemala and El Salvador in the 1980s as when he was serving as Assistant Secretary of State under President Ronald Reagan. Abrams dismissed reports that El Salvador's U.S.-trained military had massacred 1,000 civilians, including children, in the Salvadoran town of El Mazote in December 1981. He's also been linked to the 2002 attempted coup against Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and helped plan the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Under President Trump, Abrams served as special envoy to Iran and Venezuela. Abrams will need to be confirmed by the Senate to serve on the commission. The United Nations is warning rates of severe malnutrition in Ethiopia have risen sharply, with nearly 9 million people needing food aid in the war-ravaged northern region. The World Food Program and the U.S. government, Ethiopia's two largest food donors, both halted deliveries to Tigray in April, saying the food was being diverted away from those in need. A Tigrayan official said hundreds have died, including children, since the aid was withdrawn, calling the situation extremely desperate. In Israel, tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets of Tel Aviv Wednesday evening after the city's police commander announced he's resigning under pressure from senior Israeli government officials. Commander Ami Eshed said he would rather step aside than follow the demands of cabinet members who demanded a violent crackdown on protesters opposed to plans by the far-right government of Benjamin Netanyahu to gut Israel's judiciary. This is a protester speaking Wednesday.
I'm here today because I'm an Israeli who cares about democracy. I know that if the government decided to fire the head police officer of Tel Aviv only because he decided that it's legal to protest, I think this is one step further for Israel to be a non-democratic state.
There were no mass protests in Israel over this week's two-day raid in Jenin, which killed 12 Palestinians, including four children, displaced thousands of residents, and razed homes to the ground. Back in the United States, unionized UPS drivers and warehouse workers are moving closer to a strike after contract negotiations broke down Wednesday. More than 340,000 UPS workers represented by the Teamsters are fighting for better wages and soaring cost of living increases in company profits. The current contract expires July 31st. In more labor news, thousands of Los Angeles hotel workers returned to work Wednesday after a three-day strike over the busy July 4th weekend. Workers say more stoppages are to be expected until a deal is reached on fair wages, health care and pension benefits, and improved working conditions. And in a major victory for baristas, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Starbucks violated federal labor law when it fired workers at several Pittsburgh stores who were organizing their co-workers. Starbucks now has over 330 unionized coffee shops. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show in Ukraine. Overnight, a Russian missile strike hit a residential building in the western city of Lviv, killing four, injuring 32 others. Meanwhile, in eastern Ukraine, an airstrike triggered a massive fireball in the Russian-occupied city of Makivka. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky vowed there would be a, quote, tangible response. This comes as Ukrainians gathered Tuesday to mourn the death of renowned writer Victoria Amelina. She died as a result of injuries from a Russian strike on a restaurant in Kramatorsk last week, which killed 13 people. Amelina was part of a human rights group, Truth Hounds, investigating Russian war crimes. She had been meeting with a group of Colombians at a restaurant in Kramatorsk when she died. She was remembered by her peers during a funeral service in Kyiv.
It was important to her to travel to the deoccupied areas and gather testimonies about Russia's crimes and tell the world about it as much as she can. We did not only lose a writer and poet in her prime, but also a human rights defender, an honest and shining voice on the international stage.
For more, we're joined by Andrei Kirkov, one of Ukraine's best-known authors, former president of PEN Ukraine. He was a friend of Victoria Amelina. His tribute to her in The Guardian is headlined, "Her smile sparkled even in the most difficult times." Andrei is the author of dozens of books, most recently Diary of an Invasion. Welcome back to Democracy Now! And our deepest condolences to you, Andrei Kirkov. She was not only a well-known writer, but a friend of yours. Can you tell us about Victoria Amelina, how she lived and then how she died?
Well, she was a normal person. She actually looked very shy when if you just saw her in the street. She was a nice, always smiling and shyly smiling person who changed her, I would say, way of life several times because when she was 14, she was taken by her father to Canada to immigration. And later, several years later, she decided to go back to Ukraine, to her favorite and her own city of Lviv, where she studied computer sciences and she became a very good programmer. And then she decided to quit the job and to become a writer. And she was writing poems, essays, and she published two novels. But from 2014-15, after the Euromaidan, she became very politically engaged, very socially engaged. She became a member of PEN Ukraine. She immediately started organizing campaigns to free Alexei Sov from Russian prison. I am talking about a film director and writer from Crimea who was accused by Russians of terrorist activities, which was a false accusation, of course, who spent 5 years in a Russian prison. And since then, she was actually more, I think, active politically and socially than literally, because she was, just didn't have enough time to write. And also when she was wounded in Kramatorsk, she was there together with our colleagues from Latin America, from representatives of the pro-Ukrainian movement Aguanta Ukraina, Resist Ukraine. And also, I mean, she died on the 1st of July, which is the birthday of another writer, Vladimir Vakulenko, who was killed 1 year ago by Russian military, and whose body she was looking for several months before his body was identified in November in the mass grave near Kharkiv region city of Izum. And she recovered his last diaries that he hid under the tree, under the cherry tree of his parents' garden. Actually, several days before she was wounded, on 22nd of June, she was presenting the book, posthumous book of Volodymyr Vakulenko, where these diaries were included. So she was one of the most active Ukrainian authors and I would say political and literary activists, yeah.
Andrei, could you talk about, you've said, I mean, she was working on, since the invasion, documenting war crimes in Ukraine. Yeah. If you could say, she was working on her first nonfiction book in English about war crimes being documented by Ukrainian women. The book was to be titled War and Justice Diary, Looking at Women, Looking at War. Could you talk about that?
Well, this book was almost finished. I think it's like 80% of the book she wrote. She wrote it in English so that it would become easier accessible to the publishers abroad. Last 16 months, she was traveling all the time, either to the front lines, to the recently liberated Ukrainian territories, and then immediately to the States, to Europe, to report on the atrocities committed by the Russian army. And all this was for the sake of the book, which will be published, I believed. I don't know yet the name of the publisher, but this was her last project, and it will remain her last project.
Andrei, could you talk about, I mean, she is one of dozens of writers who have been killed, writers, filmmakers who've been killed since the war began. Could you talk about some of the others who've died in these months, over a year, since the Russian invasion?
Well, we have about 30, or maybe probably already more, artistic personalities who became victims of this war, victims of Russian army shellings, or who were killed on the front lines as soldiers. I mentioned already Volodymyr Vakulenko, who was author of books for children, who decided to not to evacuate from his village Kapitolivka in the eastern Ukraine because of his severely disabled son, and who was first taken for questioning in the beginning of March, and then returned home. And second time he was taken for questioning, and he was never seen again. And he was finally buried in December last year. He's remembered as one of the most sort of tragic victims of this war. I can mention, of course, many others, including Yuri Ruf, who was killed in action. Also a poet from Lviv who volunteered to become a soldier and who was fighting in eastern Ukraine. But, I mean, probably we will have a separate book with texts written by authors killed by the Russian aggression published in the nearest future. I mean, we don't know when the war is going to end, but it will cost a lot for Ukrainian culture, obviously.
Andrei Kirkov, we talked to you just over a year ago. You were here in New York with a big pen event. You were talking about your book, Gray Bees, which is known all over. You've written a new book now. It's called Diary of an Invasion. explain how you started writing it. You went back to Ukraine after we spoke, and you just came back to Kyiv as well. You were out of the country. Explain the situation for you as a writer in Ukraine now.
Well, I mean, I do write diaries, but I was writing mostly articles and essays about what was happening from the very beginning of the war and also before the new invasion. And I was asked by my English publisher, Christopher McLaughlin, to send him the texts, which I did. And in the end, actually, the book was published first in London in October last year. It covers the events in Ukraine from December 21 till July 22. And it includes also not only my diary notes, but also articles and essays that I wrote for international media and published in the newspapers like The Guardian, The Financial Times, or in the magazines like The New Statesman and Spectator. Actually, I continue to write essays about what is happening now, and probably they will be included in the second volume of the diaries.
Andrei Kirkov, again, our condolences on the death of your friend and a friend to so many, the Ukrainian writer Victoria Amelina. Andrei Kirkov, one of Ukraine's best-known authors, former president of PEN Ukraine. His tribute to her in The Guardian will link to her smile sparkled even in the most difficult times. Andrei is the author of dozens of books, including Gray Bees, his most recent diary of an invasion. We're going now from Kyiv to Moscow to look at how the prominent Russian journalist Elena Milashina has been diagnosed with a brain injury and multiple fractures after she was violently attacked July 4th, along with attorney Alexander Nemov, while on their way to the court sentencing of a human rights activist in Grozny, Chechnya's capital. Unknown assailants beat them, shaved off Elena's hair, doused her in blue-green liquid iodine. Her fingers were reportedly broken because she resisted demands to unlock her phone. Elena Milashina reports for Novaya Gazeta, exposing human rights abuses in Chechnya. She described the harrowing attack from the hospital where she was being treated.
It was like a classic kidnap, like the ones they used to do. It just hasn't happened in a long time. They came, threw the taxi driver out of the car. They got in, put my head down and tied my hands. They put me on my knees and a pistol to my head.
Elena Milashina works for the newspaper Novaya Gazeta, one of the last independent media outlets in Russia, co-founded by the Nobel Peace Laureate Dmitry Muratov, stripped of its media license last year. For more, we go to Moscow to speak with Anna Dobrovskaya. She served as the executive director of Memorial Human Rights Center in Moscow before it was shut down by the Russian government last year. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Under very sad circumstances, as we report on the death of the Ukrainian writer Victoria Amelina, and now the savage attack on Elena Milashina in Chechnya. Can you talk about the circumstances, what you understand? We had her in our studio years ago talking about the gravity of the situation in Chechnya. Now it's different, but she's still been brutalized.
Hello, Amy. Thank you for having me back. Yes, Elena Milashina, as you said, is one of the bravest Russian journalists who worked a lot covering the human rights violations in Chechnya. And she was indeed on her way to a court hearing in Grozny, but it was not a human rights activist. It was actually a mother of three human rights and oppositional activists, Ian Gulbayev brothers, who all of them are outside of Russia at the moment, but their mother was taken as a hostage. And on the day of attack against Elena and Alexander, Zarema Musayeva, it's her name. She was sentenced to five and a half years in prison for the falsified case of fraud. This is unfortunately one of the multiple cases when human rights activists are being abused and suppressed, so they would either leave the region and leave the country or stop talking altogether. This is done so her sons would return back to Russia, and if they do this, they immediately will be taken by Chechen authorities, and we can most surely say that they will be tortured to death or killed right away. So Yelena Milashina from Novaya Gazeta, together with Alexander Nemov, who is a lawyer from Committee Against Torture, attorney at law, they were on their way to be at the court hearing. And as Yelena described, they were very brutally attacked. It was not the first attack against Yelena in Chechnya. The last time she was attacked about two years ago. It was also in Grozny, also on her way to one of the human rights trial, and she is probably one of the few persons who always comes back. I cannot say I wish she comes back to Chechnya after what happened, because it's a very clear signal that next time it will be even more brutal than that.
Anna, she was actually, in addition, of course, to having been attacked before, Kadyrov, the head of the Chechen Republic, openly threatened her in 2022, last year, calling her a terrorist and terrorist accomplice and demanding her arrest. So could you talk about that? And therefore, given his open comments, public comments about her, it was quite extraordinary that she went, because she must have known that she would once again be targeted.
It's both predictable and unpredictable when exactly you will be targeted if you go to Chechnya. There is a saying that whoever tells you that it is difficult to work in Chechnya, do not believe them, because it's impossible to work there. And of course, Yelena knew this very well, but still she made this choice to go and to demonstrate that she is not afraid, that human rights lawyers are not afraid of going, that attorneys are not afraid to go there, though it is becoming more and more dangerous. Yes, Kadyrov openly, publicly said this speech terrorizing her and blaming her as a terrorist and saying that there will be some consequences. And I think there was a criminal case open because of this speech, but these cases never go anywhere. And right now, the criminal case was also open because of this attack, because of attack on Yelena and Alexander. And somehow the reaction of like federal authorities is very, very unique. They are saying that this is absolutely impossible. This has to be investigated. But at the same time, Chechen authorities says that none of that was recorded on the security cameras. We don't know who those people were. We just basically know nothing about them, but we will keep looking. So it's like a very common response by the Chechen authorities, and actually almost all the other authorities in Russia. Whenever a human rights defender, a journalist, and an independent lawyer is being attacked, it's more or less always the same response. And we still don't know who killed Natalia Estimirova, and we still have no clear picture on the killing of Anna Politkovskaya. So unfortunately, it's continuing to go this way.
Anna, wasn't Elena also covering the situation for the LGBT community in Chechnya?
It was the coverage, yes, of situation with LGBT community, but more important than that, it was she was covering the location and existence of the secret prisons in Chechnya. And it's not solely targeting the LGBT community, mostly men, but it was targeting basically every it's not activist, but every person who would speak openly something against Kadyrov's regime. Basically, no one could have been could have still saved in Chechnya if he or she wanted to say something against. But at some point, a particular wave of repression was targeted LGBT men, gay men, and unfortunately, yeah, there was a wave of that. We don't know what is happening with that now, because the region is extremely closed. Memorial was evicted from Chechnya in 2018 after our colleague Oyub was also imprisoned under falsified case. And since that time, it's only very random visits of human rights defenders. And unfortunately, they continue to be attacked there.
And while you were head of Memorial Human Rights Center, as you said, you worked on documenting war crimes in Chechnya. If you could talk about the period you covered and also explain Kadyrov's rise to power. His father had fought against the Russians in the First Chechen War, but then changed sides in the second Chechen war. So could you explain the position he now occupies, how he came to occupy that position, and his relationship to Putin?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chechnya is a very particular part of Russia with a it's a beautiful region with a very tragic episodes of history. It was one of the strongest separatist movement after Russia became independent from the Soviet Union, and people were bravely struggling to gain more independence or to gain, you know, more fair negotiations about their status with the federal authorities. Unfortunately or fortunately, they didn't succeed, like it didn't happen, but then